Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The partial restoration of Chartres Cathedral that took place from 2014 to 2016 focused on the nave, stained glass windows, and first figures in the ambulatory. The 2016 film, directed by Anna Savalli, Chartres, La Lumière Retrouvée, documents this meticulous process through observation and conversations with numerous restorers, archaeologists, scientists, and architects. On November 25, 2018, the National Gallery of Art hosted the Washington premiere of the documentary, which was introduced by Dominique Lallemand, president of the American Friends of Chartres. Afterwards, scholars Madeleine Cavanis and Ellen Shortell joined in conversation to discuss the importance and impact of this renovation, as well as the complexities of this two-year restoration project. This program is held in collaboration with American Friends of Chartres and the Embassy of France.
Good afternoon. Notre Dame de Chartres, as most of you know, is one of the most famous and beautiful Gothic cathedrals in the world. The monument we see today, towering over the wheat fields, was built on top of the remains of the Romanesque cathedral, which had been destroyed by one of the many fires common in the Middle Ages. Notre Dame de Chartres was last rebuilt in about 25 years after the fire of 1194. Fortunately, some of the 12th century stained glass windows survived that fire. In particular, the one commonly known as Notre Dame de la Belle Verrière, or the Blue Madonna. Today, Notre Dame de Chartres hosts the largest collection under one roof of 12th and 13th century stained glass windows. Conserving such a monument is a challenge. Many changes were made to the cathedral over the past nine centuries, some considered as embellishments, such as the stone choir enclosure in the 16th century and the Baroque choir decor of the 18th century. The cathedral survived the French Revolution, during which it was used as a grain storage hangar. It also survived World War I and World War II. In 1944, during the liberation of France, the cathedral was saved from destruction thanks to an American soldier, Colonel Wellborn Griffith. On August 16, 1944, taking upon himself to go behind enemy lines, Colonel Griffith found that the cathedral was empty and managed to have General Patton rescind the order of shelling the cathedral. That same day, he was killed in an ambush in the nearby town of Lèves. Thanks to his courage, the cathedral remained intact. American Friends of Chartres honors his memory. As a little girl, I always dreamed of climbing up to the rooftops of cathedrals, see closely the gargoyles and the stained glass. Little would I know that one day this dream would come true. So we are a fairly young organization, which was set up in 2005. And we started, in a way, at the initiative of a French organization called Chartres Sanctuaire du Monde, which was established over 20 years ago and raises funds in Europe. And the dream of the founders was that there would be a sister organization in the U.S. To raise funds in the U.S. So we are a nonprofit organization, and we have our mission is basically twofold: one, to raise funds to finance the conservation projects, and also to promote the vibrancy of the cathedral with cultural events such as this one. Our organization has a board of trustees and also an advisory board, and both Madeleine and Ellen are members of our board of advisory board. So our inaugural project was the restoration of five lancets of the south portal. And our second project was the conservation of the baker's window in the upper clerestory of the nave. So you can see on the left, you know, a view of the panels before they were restored. Here is a close-up comparison between a panel when it's first taken down and then after the first test of restoration and the conservation, final conservation work. Our third project, which we just completed, is the restoration of five statue columns and a few other stone elements, which will be permanently exhibited in the treasury of the cathedral. And presently, they are in exhibit at the Cluny Museum in Paris till mid-January. So in case you travel to Paris in the meantime, make time to see that exhibit about the emergence of Gothic sculpture, which is quite beautiful. Our next projects are the restoration of two bay windows in the north transept, one with the story of St. Anne and the other one the story of St. Philip, St. Jude, and St. André, and possibly also the restoration of a small panel from the Jubé, the nativity scene. And it so happens that the head of Joseph is missing from the panel, but it is in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Our goal is to raise $500,000 for this project, so we have some ways to go. We will also continue to have a number of smaller projects. We would like to develop our scholarship program. So far, we've given only one scholarship, but we want to encourage both French artists or art historians to come to the U.S. and likewise to have American scholars and artists to go to France and study medieval art or stained glass in particular. And we've also organized our first donor trip last September. This is a picture of the current condition of some of the panels on your left of the story of St. Anne and on the right of St. Philip and St. Jude. As you can see, they are in dire need of conservation. Here is a plan of this cathedral with all the location of the stained glass, and in the red frames you see the southern the five lancets of the south portal, then the bay 140, and then in the transept the two windows that we propose to restore. In 2017, we celebrated our $500,000 raised since 2005. And this is an opportunity for me to thank the many donors who are in this room and are contributing with such generosity that we are able to support the projects which I have described. Today we're about 160 donors, and we've had also a few corporate gifts as well, or donations, I should say, and grants from foundations. So join us, and don't hesitate to write to us at friendsofchartres@yahoo.com. We have a Facebook page, which is also American Friends of Chartres. And I was just thinking, actually, if you want to give us some feedback on the film, it's good to do it on Facebook. I think it will intrigue other people. And we definitely would like to be able to welcome you in Chartres. So thank you very much. And I know now I will let Ellen and Madeline make their presentation.
Several years ago, just as the restoration work at Chartres was beginning, the eminent Swiss art historian Brigitte Corman-Schwarz predicted that the results of the restoration efforts would make us rethink the interiors of high Gothic buildings, that is to say, of the great churches constructed in the late 12th and early 13th centuries, for which Chartres has long stood as an archetype. As you've just heard, the American Friends of Chartres has supported the cleaning and conservation of many of the windows, and that has had a spectacular effect on one's experience of the interior architecture. That effect is heightened by the revelation of the 13th century wall treatment. And I imagine that some of you are aware of some of the aspects of the restoration have engendered some controversy. The treatment of the interior stone surfaces has been a particular object of that criticism. You saw in the film a discussion of the repainting of the keystones that highlights some of the decision-making that goes into restoration. And there it was pointed out that the decision of the local authorities to document and refresh the paint colors to make them visible to visitors 100 feet below goes against the conservation guidelines that were formulated by ICOMOS, the International Commission on Monuments and Sites, for example. And I don't mean to, by any means, dismiss the important discussion of conservation practices that protect great monuments of history like Chartres, but I want to note that something important has been lost in this discussion, and that's what I want to emphasize. As Corman-Schwarz noted, there are important revelations here for architectural history. The 13th century color scheme of pale ochre walls with whitewashed accents, colonnettes, capitals, and architectural moldings was first discovered and published nearly 30 years ago by a German scholar, Jürgen Michler. And the restoration team has said that they found 80-90% of the original 13th century wall treatment intact. The conservator in the film demonstrates very nicely the process of removing the more recent layers and gives a very convincing explanation for its good state of preservation. The decision to do some patching of and repainting of areas of loss has also been criticized, but however we might judge that decision, what we see now is much closer to the 13th century appearance of the building than what we saw before. And I've often looked and thought about Michler's work and tried to imagine the effect of these colors. In reality, it's still surprising to see how they truly intensify the color of the glass. For example, in this comparison of this central chapel at the east end of the choir, before and after both glass cleaning and the restoration of the wall. Similar color schemes have been revealed in other 13th century buildings, including the Cathedral of Châlons-Champagne, which is to the east of Paris, and also the Cathedral of Cologne. So this suggests certainly that what we see now at Chartres was common to other Gothic buildings at the time. The pale walls now are especially dramatic and even shocking for eyes that have been used to a much darker interior. We previously tended to accept the building as it was, and not realizing how much the dark state of the walls was due to centuries of accumulated candle wax and soot. Because Chartres retains an unusual amount of its original glass, it also became, both for modern visitors and architectural historians alike, the archetype of 13th century French Gothic. The others we thought that had lost much of their original glass must once have looked like this. The dark interior of Chartres was then interpreted as appropriate to the contemplation of the mysteries of the divine and immersed, in the words of one early 20th century scholar, in a transcendental twilight. The combination of the windows restored to their original brightness and the walls to their original color schemes admits a great deal more light. Not only were the windows darkened naturally with dirt and corrosion, but also they were intentionally coated with a darkening varnish or cold paint about a century ago. The dark walls absorbed a certain amount of the light that they did admit, where the pale walls now reflect and magnify it, and to some of our surprise, they really don't wash out the color at all. They really enhance it. More recent research has shown also that many early 13th century French Gothic churches made use of a lot of white glass to illuminate selected parts of their interiors. So the quantity of colored glass that was used at Chartres was actually unique from the very beginning. Its difference from other buildings of its time was not, after all, just an accident of modern survival. So that makes its opulence all the more remarkable. Architectural historians also developed a historical model that says that sometime around 1270, there was a dramatic change in taste, as builders created interiors with a profusion of finely sculpted elements. And to make those visible, illuminated them with a much lighter palette of glass, as you see here at the church on the left of Saint-Urbain in Troyes in Champagne. It now seems, though, that the transition to a light-filled interior might not have been quite so abrupt as was once thought, since we were actually not starting with such a low level of light as Chartres led us to think before. In addition to the brightness of the interior, we learned something about the place of structural innovation at Chartres. Previous Gothic buildings in northern France, like the Cathedral of Laon, which you see here, had four stories with complex patterns of arches at each level. And these created in the older buildings a series of horizontal rhythms with a more plastic and textured wall. The builders at Chartres were among the first to simplify the elevation by eliminating the second story and increasing the height of the clear story. This created larger windows that admitted a greater amount of light directly into the central part of the building. The effect is a flatter wall with a balance between vertical and horizontal elements that lend the building a linear quality, and that has been seen as a characteristic of High Gothic architecture. There was also a fundamental change in the way that the supporting elements were built. The early Gothic buildings employed bundles of what are called andelie shafts, that is, freestanding colonnettes, andelie meaning literally cut from the bed, and they are cut from the bed and turned 90 degrees to make them vertical so that the grain of the limestone runs vertically and creates a very smooth appearance. It also is a very weak element as far as support is concerned. In fact, these shafts support virtually nothing other than their own weight, and they're primarily visual. They decorated not only the wall, but also appeared as elements of the piers, and the piers consist of a central core with separate shafts around them. They were secured in place with rings, and those rings were coursed into the wall. But at Chartres, a new pier type, which was known as the pilier cantonné, a cantonated pier, made its appearance. And it creates the appearance at first of a central core surrounded by shafts, but it actually is constructed in horizontal slices, and so each layer is a unit. This coursing then continues for the full height of the wall, and you see a contrast here between the early Gothic pier with truly separate shafts and the way that piers were cut from Chartres forward in courses, in horizontal courses. So the coursing continues the full height of the wall, and the stones that are destined to be part of a wall certainly need to be strong, so they were cut with the grain running horizontally and laid that way on the wall, so they take advantage of the stone's natural strength. Well, as I mentioned, the andelie shafts support no weight. And in fact, they have to be installed with some room to move so that as the wall settles and the stones settle at a different, in a different way, there's room to avoid cracking. It's been thought that this change was part of a new aesthetic at Chartres, one that emphasized the structural elements as part of the visual effect. At least that was an early 20th century description of Gothic architecture. However, now that we see that these shafts were whitewashed so that the mortar joints disappear and so that they stand out from the flat surface of the wall and from the central part of the pier, it seems that the builders of Chartres wanted to maintain an illusion of andelie shafts around the main piers in the wall elevation, but with a stronger structure. The colored walls also act with the windows and other elements to create a unified decorative scheme that unites the windows with the rest of the interior, rather than isolating them floating in the dark. In the nave, the restorers uncovered multicolored colonnettes in the triforium and finely carved capitals that were once hidden in the shadows now stand out in white. They reflect the colored light of the windows, and those like the ones you see here that sit between the windows reflect the color of the windows, and I think one is more likely to draw a connection between the leafy borders of the windows, such as this, and the leaf forms of the capitals. In the western bays of the nave, the restorers also discovered figural wall paintings that prolong the form of the colored stained glass in an opaque medium. And these false rosettes that you see here contain images of King David, and they are up here so that they continue the form of the windows even against a blank wall. And lastly, I'll come back to those problematic keystones. It does indeed go against conservation standards in general to repaint things. However, what we learn from this process not only is what the original keystones looked like, and it does appear that the original patterns were carefully documented before they were covered, they do accent the center line of the building and resonate with the colors of the windows, the triforium supports, and the wall paintings, as well as the architectural polychromy of the wall surfaces and the sculptural elements. So all of this together leaves us with a very different image of the interior, in which the windows really no longer seem to hang in the air, but have really become part of the wall and illuminate the interior far more than I think any of us anticipated they would do.
Thank you, Denise. Good afternoon. I won't keep you too much longer. You've already had a visual feast, but it's really a delight to be here and to share some thoughts and images with you. As Alan already articulately pointed out, there has been some concern whether one should be restoring, that is, trying to put back lost pigment. And certainly a boss like this, beautifully cleaned, if it were in a museum, that would be how you would display it. It would be close to the eye. But it is a dilemma. In a monument like Chartres, and there are two aspects of that, I think. One is that almost everything is very far from you. And the other is that there's so much of it. As you saw, this is an immense building. So you couldn't take the care with every leaf, you would think, that you might in a museum, or you would do it differently. And we might come back to some of those issues in discussion if you like. But I do agree with Ellen that, shocking as it is when you isolate these repainted keystones with the rather hard edge of the color against the stone, and when you look at the ensemble from below, there is a kind of extraordinary unity now that brings the north and south clerestory lights, the right and left, together with a knot in the center in much the same colors, and because of some gilding with the same brilliance. Now, there is another kind of archaeological point there, which came up somewhat in the film discussion. There were two layers also of painting and these keystones. The 14th century went back to add more brilliant color. And you also heard that they repainted most of the masonry in a deeper yellow. They were supplying their own critique, I think, of the effects that they were seeing. But it reminds us that this was a living monument and so often retouched. But it is quite extraordinary, I think, that they were able to go back to the 13th century masonry patterns. Now, again, it has been a revelation in the just simply removing dust and dirt. The choir was quite a shock to people. We saw the beautiful sculpture outside the choir screen that was being cleaned in the film. The inside was decorated in the same campaigns of the 16th century And in fact, you can see on the dirty dark slide here that color was always there, but most of us never noticed it. And some people who returned to Chartres after it had been cleaned off said, they repainted it. But actually, and I think that's where repainting the bosses began to give a bad impression, because the keystones were, but nothing much else has been touched. And again, I thoroughly agree that the stained glass, not only because it's been cleaned, but because it is in a lighter stone surround, reads more clearly. It's more delightful to look at, actually. And it was, as Helen said, an old aesthetic, a belief, a firm belief of the stained glass artists of the 20th century, that you had to have a dark stone surround. And I think she may be right that it was the dirtiest building of all was Chartres, and that was the model. The Boston glass painter Connick, who did so much wonderful glass in this country, took one of his copies of a publication on Bourges from 1841 with beautiful colored plates, and he painted around the plates to try and make the glass reproduction look more brilliant, because that was the aesthetic, he believed, and all of us believed it until we really could reevaluate with Chartres. Again, the glass was extremely dark before this work was done, and that's very distressing because it had been cleaned earlier in the 20th century, and it had been cleaned in the 19th century. And it's not only dirt. I think one of the misconceptions you might have is that those are also deposits from the atmosphere. And also the glass is breaking down. The sulfates and the potassium break out, so some of it powders off. Acidic rain can dissolve medieval glass, and it forms pits, and then the pits fill with dirt, and it looks like a dirty freckles. And actually, one of the things that my friend Claudine Lutier was doing, she had this very wry, wonderful, we have to touch it. She's not touching to find if it's dirty. She's touching because glass has a particular undulating surface, medieval glass. And that's how we tell when we have to do these charts for the Corpus Victorarum, touch it piece by piece. And she's quite right. And I've been in many museums where I needed to do that, and somebody faints and has to be carried away to the conservation department. Now, I've been fortunate enough for some years now to make an annual pilgrimage to Chartres. I happen to have a board meeting there every February. It's a little bit cold, but I got on the train usually with Claudine, and we've been up the scaffolds together, and we've looked at so many aspects of what is going on there. So a few of these pictures are my own from that scaffold. But what I would say, of course, about photography, and we really all know this, it's a very tricky business. And our eye is capable of adjusting much more quickly to different lights, and a photograph can give an impression of glass being faded out, when actually it's very brilliant. It's just that there's too much contrast going on for your camera, or at least for my camera here. So my total impression was much more homogeneous than we see on the right here. Well, partway through, again, the Friends of Chartres, of course, were not involved in this stage of the restoration, as the French insist on calling it, conservation. But I was able to see it close to, and since it's also been discussed a lot, I think it's worth, again, thinking about what they were doing there. And really, they were cleaning. And as you can see in the untouched places, it's not only dirt, but there are cracks. So the sort of 19th century film, sometimes a plaster put over the vaults, could be covering up all kinds of structural problems. If you have a vault of this kind leaking for any period of time, it will simply collapse. So it's a practical, important aspect to this, to have to go up every now and again and see what's really going on from below as well as from above under the roof. The surround for the rosettes and the clerestory is particularly interesting to us because here this plate tracery was almost white. It's the palest part of the coloration of the interior. And that turned out to work very well with the glass, as we'll see. But there are, of course, places here where there was loss of the original coating, and that was filled in with the same materials, essentially. You know, one of the caveats with restoration or conservation is to use the similar compositions, the same chemical composition. So they were extremely meticulous in doing that and using only paints and pigments and plasters that matched the original. And they've just done some infill there and haven't painted the masonry back on it yet. So when this glass was reinstalled in the Cloister rosettes, with that light surround, it becomes, at least as one's eye or camera sees it, just the right shade of slightly darker than, or more opaque, of course, than the glass, but it sets it off incredibly powerfully, I think. And we saw a little bit what went into working on just one of these rosettes, of which there are so many all the way through the building. One thing I would want to notice here is the skill of the original designers. Let me go back one moment. Yes, with this circle in the center, you can see that the original designer was able to put the necessary iron bars of support, although they're within the pictorial field. He's managed to position them, or position his figures, in such a way that they merge fairly well into darker areas of the composition. But he couldn't always do that with his composition, so with this wonderful St. George here and his gleaming armor and white horse, we do see the iron bars very clearly. But he enlivened the blue ground by adding red besants for no other reason than that was the right color to put in there to make it a more lively and wonderful panel. And of course, if you contrast now a photograph of the glass and any kind of reproduction that you can get, no matter how good, on paper, it is not the same thing. So people who came away saying, well, the glass has been overcleaned, it's too bright, it is brighter when you see it. That's just the way glass is. Here's, again, details you've seen a little before from the Amy de Chartres project, one of the first ones, this wonderful transept window with lancets across it with these prophets holding up the evangelists, were cleaned and conserved and protected outside, and I'll come to that in a moment, by the Amy de Chartres. The finished effect is quite extraordinary on the right. It's the two right-hand figures on the left. You can see how the upper part of one of them is almost opaque. Now, these medieval glass painters also seemed, there were many shops then, there were many restoring now, as we heard, but many shops then, because Chartres had so much glass to be put in, and it's been a little fun for art historians over the years to think who's using what kind of iron armature design and what colors do they prefer and how do they design their figures. And I think you can get a sense here that the shop on the right liked to put a lot more red in that window. So they would presumably prepare large batches of colored glass so that you will find that the yellows throughout a window or the greens throughout a window are in the same harmonious range. It's like a painter preparing his palette before painting, but having sort of everything, every color that he's going to use ready before really starting the work. And of course, these are immense windows. They're 25 feet high, each one, I suppose. Well, one of the things about the stonework and glass of Chartres is that they sort of respect each other. I think, as Alan said, they complement each other in an extraordinary way now. Medieval glass tends not to shed its color outside the frame. It doesn't usually cast it onto the stone. And that's because it's so undulating and surface so uneven that it is constantly fracturing the light going through, so it doesn't come straight through and make a prismatic echo. I'm contrasting here on the right in Sagrada Familia. Wonderful, actually, the glass painter is there in his own surrounding. Joan Vilagran, one of the great Catalan painters who designed all the windows for Gaudí's Sagrada Familia. It's now finished. And he was able to anticipate the thing that modern glass does, which is to scatter, to spread colored light way beyond the windows. And he very carefully calculated that that would fall in the right amount in the right way and not create some sort of unanticipated color mix. But I think it's very interesting that medieval glass doesn't do that. Now, we saw a good deal of the detailed work to be done in removing mending leads from almost every face, and this again is the transept window. And the effect immediately, of course, is that these faces are more legible to us, they're more uniform. And in terms of conservation, a very important effect to take a great deal of the weight out of the panel, because the more mending lead they put in, lead is very heavy. And they had anticipated, of course, in the Middle Ages, as we saw, those iron bars at certain intervals, usually about 25 or 30 inch intervals. And that was sufficient as they had been glazed at the time. But by the time you add a lot of mending leads, you can have the panels buckling, and so it's almost self-defeating. Here's, again, the process of taking out of the leads, cleaning the pieces, edge mending. There were experiments in much of the late 20th century with exactly what adhesives to use. We used to have international meetings in which it was hotly debated which one works, which one is reversible, which is one of course, the important things about conservation. You don't add a material or something like a glue that you can't melt out again. So I think they do really have the right solution now. Problems, as we saw on the right here, old replacements in the glass, which became much more obvious when they were cleaned. And so that's the kind of thing that we saw them putting a wash over to bring it down a bit. These brownish purples, that's the trickiest of all the medieval colors. It's a manganese glass, which darkens a little bit with time anyway. And then it's very prone to being dissolved in acidic rain and so on. And so it's usually very much attacked. It's remarkable that these pieces are still fairly intact, but you can't take cleaning beyond a certain point. And I think, you know, one of the interesting differences about the way they've worked there with the keystones and the way the stained glass people work, who've been really thinking about these problems for so long, is that in the stained glass, they know it's better to keep the old restoration. That's part of the history of the panel. We had great 19th century painters working on pieces like this, so you don't want to throw that out and put something that looks better. And you don't repaint figures. And for me, the problem again with the sculpture is, well, if it's just architectural detail, that's one thing, but if you're repainting beautifully carved figures on a keystone, it becomes a little bit something else. And certainly with the glass, you wouldn't want to do whole-scale repainting. But on the left, you can see the kind of documentation that was done with this immense head of an angel, which is one that St. Michael that hovers over the main altar in the choir of Chartres. It's one of the biggest figures there is of all. And the three colors there apparently delineate different layers of original paint. And sometimes those really disappear into the damaged glass. So again, they're not going to repaint that. They don't repaint that. And my last point is, again, conservation. And I think it's, you know, it's wonderfully dramatic to walk in that building and see everything clean, and everybody in this room gasped. Maybe some of you in horror, perhaps, but I hope most of you think, what a fantastic revelation. But there is no point cleaning stained glass unless, when it goes back, it's protected on the outside. Over and over again, they've gone through this process. They cleaned all the windows of Bourges Cathedral, which are as wonderful as Chartres. There aren't as many, but they're wonderful windows. And within a decade, the glass was darkening again. And to some extent then, you've removed almost a protective layer of dirt, and so it's attacked even more. So this invisible outer glazing, which, again, it's a technique, I think, that's now been perfected after 70 years of debate, or 100 actually, 1860 is the first date known, that they protected windows from the outside with plate glass. It didn't always work in the early experiments. Merton College in Oxford, the space between the old glass and the new filled with water, and nobody realized as it went on filling up with water until they happened to have to get the windows out, and they were just amazed at, oh goodness, there was a swimming pool inside. So the glass has to be vented, so they have to have air circulating. And again, the Austrians at first said to the outside, and the Americans said to the inside, and we went over that for many years. Well, usually to the inside, so that you equalize the temperature and humidity, and you have to be able to monitor what's happening in between. But as I say, those things have been solved, and the result is not unaesthetically, well, it's not ugly. The architects used to say, no, we can't do it. We can't have plate glass gleaming in the sun on the outside of our cathedral. But it doesn't, and the new method of doing this with modifying the surface of that glass, I think, has really worked very well. So onward and upward with the Amina Sharp. Let's treat more windows. Let's be sure that they're properly protected. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.